All right. What were you thinking? What came out of your conversation?
Firstly, Tom, great to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks a million. I think you're raising fundamental questions. From a school point of view, how one can break that rut?
Well, Kevin, there's no easy answer at all, as you well know, no better than I. I, you know, go around giving talks, whereas you're at the pit face. But it's always possible, I think, to sow a seed of faith. And I think sowing the seed, I'm going to talk about this is before we finish today. To me, evangelization is about sowing the seed. Catechesis, religious education is about growing the seed. But you're absolutely right. It's very difficult to grow a seed if there's none there. And it's typically planted, I suppose, or most likely planted in the early years. But this may sound pious piffle, but the grace of God is always at work. And it's never impossible. And you can take, I think, and give people, somebody said the experience. You said the youth word is yourself. It is possible to give young people, we'll talk about that mid-morning this afternoon, experiences of faith that could be the sowing of the seed, where they say, God, now that's something, that's interesting. I never thought of that before. I never felt that before. Karl Rahner says that if there's going to be Christians in the future, they'll all have to be mystics. And what he means is they'll all have to have somehow experienced God, experienced Jesus Christ in their life. And if they've never experienced him, then he's just Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, whatever. He's just another myth. But I think it is possible to craft our pedagogy, even in a high school level, secondary school level. Pardon my American terms when they come out. I grew up with yours. It is possible to structure, I think, the life and the pedagogy of our secondary schools so that we might be a little more likely not just to do information, but perhaps formation, and maybe even transformation. It's a lot more difficult. And if they come in with that seed, then we can definitely nurture it. But I wouldn't give up just because they're 12. Yeah.
And even it might be later on in their lives
when
they come back to faith. So
sure.
Keep sowing the
seed. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I tell a story in one of my books about a young man I taught at Boston College who was the biggest pain in the neck I ever had in class. It was my second year teaching. I was in a major university. I was terrified, scared to death. And this kid was an avowed, disruptive, obnoxious atheist. He drove me crazy. Kevin was his name, by the way. Sorry, Kevin. Kevin. And of course, you know Darren well. His name, like Kevin, he was Irish, and his mother was from Mayo, and his father was from, who knows, Roscommon, probably. But anyway. But he came back about 25 years later, and he said, oh, God, Professor, I'm so involved in my parish. You won't believe it. I'm the chair of the parish council, and I'm this, that, and the other. And I was sitting there with my mouth open. And he had a young boy with him. And he says Kevin Jr. here is 17. He says he wants to come to Boston College, and I told him that he has to take your course. I said, oh God, no, Kevin, no. I hope you know. You're welcome to come, but God, please don't take my course, because your father drove me mad. But here he was a devout, pious, practicing Catholic. Anyway, you never know the grace of God. And you can remember my line at the beginning. Do you know what you're supposed to do? You're supposed to do the best you can. That's all you're supposed to do. Do the best you can. You can't guarantee any outcome. And St. Paul says it's always God who gives the increase. You know, some people sow seeds, other people water them. It's God who gives the growth. So the most you can do in anybody's life is do the best you can. But great comments. Other thoughts, reflections, insights you're having yourself?
I think the fact that you've just spoken about setting the seeds of faith is really interesting, because both myself and Tracy,
absolutely. It's a great point. Yeah. And putting those different disciplines in conversation with each other. It's hard work, but there's nothing more effective than co-teaching. Mm-hmm. you know, people from different disciplines try to teach these courses together, at least in, and with some of our high schools in the States have done that very successfully. And it can be a tremendous cross-fertilization, where the scientist and the religion teacher work together. And of course, there's no contradiction whatsoever. They're both powerful ways of knowing the ultimate mysteries of life. And but there can be a tremendous partnership there. Lovely thought. Another insight or a comment or wisdom you'd like to share?
What you said about experience is so true. You know, you go out of the realm of every other subject.
This is true, yeah. No, and that's challenging. And oh God, don't let me make it feel sound simple, because that would be simplistic. But we'll come back to it this afternoon. You see, for the first 1,000 years of the church's history, the primary way of knowing in the church's history, for the first 1,000 years, and especially the primary way of knowing faith, was through the spiritual. They basically did it, well, Lectio Divina. And it was a kind of a prayerful, meditative, spiritual reflection. It was their way of knowing the faith. It was grounded in the spiritual. And then for the next 1,000 years, it shifted from the heart to the head. And the scholastics, and of course, Augustine is the primary example of the spiritual approach, the appealing to people's desire, as Augustine would say. Whereas Aquinas is the great champion, of course, of appealing to people's reason. And I don't want to say one or the other, either we need both. Faith always has to make sense. It's faith seeking understanding is the great Catholic tradition of what theology is. It's faith seeking understanding. And the more you understand it, and Aquinas said, the more convinced you become of it, the more likely you are to live it. So there's a place for what the old authors called logos. There's a place for reason. But there also has to be a place for eros, for desire, and appealing to people's desires and appealing to it spiritually. And you see, I think there is a tremendous hesitation for us to do that in the context of a classroom. But why not do a 5-minute meditation? I have a friend who has taught in a technical school, as they call them here then. She's retired from it now, but thought of theology, religious education, and she used meditation regularly. They were a wild bunch of hellions up around Kinnegad. But they sometimes would ask for it. And they'd say, hey, miss, you know, we need to go to the beach. And she would put them on the beach. You're on the beach and you look down, you see a little black spot, and it start coming toward you. And after a while, you begin to realize it's a person. And then as it gets closer and closer to you, you begin to say, oh my God, it's Jesus. And he comes up and he looks and he stops at you, and he looks you straight in the eye. And what does he say with that look? What do you hear him saying? And then you look back at him and you say something to him. And then he nods, gives you a smile, gives you a hug, and then turns around and walks away. And you see him receding in the distance. Took about 3-5 minutes. She said it was transforming. On the wildest days, and these were wild, young, difficult students. But they got to the point where they would even ask her for it. And you see, we're hesitant to do that kind of thing, but there has to be opportunities, because we think we've all talk head. But I think it's through the desire, it's through the spiritual, that we'll have the experience. That's how we'll sow the seed. And if, as I said, if there's a seed there, then you can definitely educate, you can definitely teach it, you can definitely grow it. But there's all kinds of ways that I think we can draw upon a more heartfelt desire rather than purely reasonable way of knowing. We always think reason is the great, but the sociologists are saying now that the contemporary postmodern society has great doubts about reason. They say great limitations to reason. See, modernity thought that reason would solve everything and rationality would solve all the problems of the world. In fact, it brought us to the brink of nuclear destruction and the destruction of our environment. So the rationality that came out of the Industrial Revolution and the whole Descartes and Kant and all these great thinkers, that reason alone, I think, therefore I am, Descartes, rather than I love, therefore I am, or I believe, therefore I am. No, I think, therefore I am. But it was a dreadful impoverishment, purely into the mind alone. I always love Yeats's last verse of I tried to get it yesterday. Alas, it comes back after a while. It's the last verse of a poem for old age. He says, God save me from those thoughts men think in the mind alone. They that sing a lasting song think in the marrow bone. And you see, why not get kids, young people, into the marrow bone of their lives, into the what Yeats would call the deep heart's core. Now, we have to be very careful about how we go there, and you can't impose, but you can facilitate, you can suggest, you can occasion, you can set up a certain environment where it's not all just pure reason, rationality, because that does very little to bring people to faith. Now, it's a help, I'm not disparaging it, but I don't think we can rely on the mind alone. Another thought or comment? Please.
Just on what you're just talking about there, I think one of your, it might have been the last book, I'm not sure now, but you mentioned the link.
You've had to read some of my books.
I did read some of them.
Are you required? Wasn't it?
No, you did. I read it because I chose to
read it. Oh, yeah, all right. I love that. I'll give you a hug later. Well, everywhere I go, I met somebody. I had to read Tom's book when I was studying religion. I say, I'm always waiting for somebody to say, I picked up his book in the library and I couldn't put it down.
Yeah,
you know. But anyway, go ahead.
So it was the Wilderby faith, I think.
Go ahead.
You talked about the hands and the head and the heart.
The head, the heart, the hands.
And that's just when you're mentioning there, I might come across as sharp now when I'm making this criticism put in the head.
Yeah.
The ideal of trying to strike the balance.
Good on you. And it has to be a balance. It has to be a balance. So it's not just wishful thinking. It has to be a deep balance. But I suppose that just the learning about it in a purely kind of rational recall kind of way, that's terribly empty. So then how do you improve on that? And then I think a lot will be the questions you're going to ask them. We always think the teaching, what am I going to say? What am I going to say? What am I going to teach today? I think our religious educator's question is, what am I going to ask? What questions am I going to ask that could actually bring people up short and get them thinking about mystery and ultimacy and the great questions of how do you make sense out of life? Why are we here at all? Why is there anything rather than nothing? Is it all just eat, drink, and be merry because tomorrow we die? Is there anything to this beyond the immediate? Is there any hope for us at all? How would you make sense out of life? What's your deepest hunger? What's your greatest desire? I think we have to somehow get into the kinds of questions that turn them toward the mystery. And they're reasoned questions, but they'll also touch the heart. And I think if you get them telling their own story, they'll do that rationally, but they won't be able to do it dispassionately. They have to get involved with that at an emotive level. But it's certainly not easy. You say, well, how difficult it is. And I don't mean to make it sound as if it is easy, but I don't think we should throw in the towel by way of having the potential of enabling them to experience the presence of God in their lives. And maybe that's taking them out for a walk and getting them to look and to really look and maybe even to see rather than just to notice and pass by. The beauty of creation, the giftedness of life, whatever it might be. It's around us. You can come to see God in all things, as Ignatius said. But that takes a certain tutoring of the perspective. And it's very difficult. It's very challenging. But I think it's a great challenge. And I think you're enormously strategically located in the lives of a lot of wonderful young people that give you enormous potential to shape their lives forever in very life-giving and life-bringing ways that will not only be a source of life for them, but through them for the life of the world. I always love the text. It's John chapter 6, verse 51, where he says, I leave you for the life of the world. And I think that's what we're called to embody this faith for the life of the world. Now, please, please, go ahead. And then we'll shift a little bit. Go ahead. No, please, don't take your time.
Just, in our school we do the religion for junior cert, and we offer it for leaving cert. And I just find when I go into the senior cycle to the non-exam classes, I've been guilty in the past a little bit of watering it down, and, they're kind of trying to, I think, sing their tune instead of my own tune.
Yeah, good on you.
You know, and kind of, let's just do kind of morality in general. We won't mention God too much, and don't really ask them what they think about God and plastic.
Isn't that great?
And they talked, but I think sometimes we're afraid, maybe,
Sure.
Oh, their thing. And,
yeah.
Oh, they're not there.
And self-conscious and all kinds of things.
And maybe I was guilty trying to be, not popular, but, don't mention God. Don't bring that up. We've done so much of it in junior search,
Yeah.
So heady, I think.
Yes.
You don't have the chance to kind of go into the heart part.
Marvelous. What was the name of that program again?
The Alpha.
Ah, wonderful. Other people know about that. Yeah. Ah, that's.
Sometimes do it in transition year, but mine didn't do it in transition year. And yeah. I just said this year, I wanted to do something different, really explore their faith and where they were at.
Good.
So it went fantastically well. They were really responsive.
I bet.
I agree with a lot of things.
That's all right. Oh, God, no problem at all.
I want to hear where they're at.
Absolutely, absolutely. He got it, yeah. But that's marvelous. And we have a wonderful curriculum in the States called the Credo Series that does a lot of what I'm explaining here. It's actually published by Veritas. And it's a very popular, it's becoming a very popular high school curriculum in the States. And but Teddy, my son, got a poor grade in religious education 2 marking periods ago. And I said to him, Teddy, how the heck could you get a 91 in English and a 99 in math and an 87 in social studies and a 63 in theology, in religious education? How could you get a 63? He said, Dad, terrible textbook. Terrible textbook. I wrote his textbook. But it sounds like the textbook, that program is very similar. Let me push on a little bit. We are going to take a break in about 15, 16, 20 minutes, right? Is that about right, Justin? Let me just push on a little bit. Why isn't this moving now? There it is. Oh, yeah, there's a picture. That was Oxford or Cambridge or someplace. But what happened with the great universities, as I said, they took God out and they put the person there. They took gospel values out and they left learning there. They took faith out, a revelation out, and they left reason there. But it was impoverished. And I think we have an opportunity to do both. Let's talk a little bit about the context of ours. So in a sense, I wanted to situate today's work within the context of the school and the great challenges, and you've done it, I think, very well, the great challenges of what you're trying to do, but also the great opportunities and how you could, as religion teachers, religious education teachers in the school, indeed, see to and help to maintain and promote and flourish the ethos of the school as grounded in deep Catholic values, which would be tremendously inclusive of anyone who wants to participate. As I said, for me, that model that of how they've done it so well were those Pakistan schools. And they'll never have a convert, as I said, to the Catholic faith or to Christianity. Ireland, God bless her. Of old, and this, you don't have to go back too far, my village of 19, in Kildare, of 1950, Charles Taylor, great sociologist, says it takes the year 1500, that people lived in an enchanted world. I say 1950, up around Broadford, my valley, Clonard, it was an enchanted world. We believed in the spiritual. It was everywhere. Ghosts and goblins and banshees and witches and angels and saints and God and Jesus. It was all suffused with the grandeur of God. It was an enchanted world. Now the sociologists say that the whole secular age we live in has brought it into a disenchanted world, a world that's kind of, my Teddy dresses up as stuff I believe in, werewolves and witches and all kinds of things. At Halloween, we think it's a joke now, in a sense, at Halloween, that people are dressing up as things that their grandparents believed in. And the presence of God in it all. Now they're saying that we live in this secular age. Now there's all kinds of definitions and description of secularization. But Charles Taylor, one of the best commentators on all of this, yes, there's a falling off of religious practice. That's one aspect of secularization, separation out of church and state, and the church being taken out of having influence in the public forum and all this kind of thing. But Taylor says the most challenging aspect of secularization is that the conditions of belief have shifted. In other words, our society and the cultures in which we live no longer dispose towards belief. You couldn't grow up in my village up in Kildare in the 1950s and not go to Mass. You simply couldn't. It wasn't allowed. There was one old fellow, Lord have mercy on him, Joe, we'll call him, I won't give you his last name. Joe used to, he worked at the farm. He's one of my dear friends. Worked at my grandfather's farm. He was one of the huge influence in my life. But Joe didn't believe in God. But he went to Mass. And when Joe would try not to go to Mass, there'd be somebody, my mother would be knocking on his door that afternoon saying, Joe, I got a bowl of soup for you. You mustn't be feeling well. We didn't see it this morning. Oh, no, no, I was there. All right, Maggie. No, you weren't there, Joe. And I heard my grandfather say to him, Joe, if the crops fail this year, we know who to blame. I mean, you didn't grow up in that village and not go to Mass. In other words, the whole condition of it, and this is only 50, 60 years ago, was toward faith. And deeply enculturated faith. And I don't disparage that at all. I'm just saying, but something has deeply shifted. To be in that village now, you're going almost against the grain to go to Mass. So we've gone to a disenchanted world, a marginalizing of faith, where faith gets pushed to the edges. And we often think it's bad. Secularization is bad. No, some of it is the best of good things. Some of it is advancements in medical science. And advancement in all kinds of ways. I mean, the village I grew up in, I don't mean to caricature at all, I'm talking about the 1950s, but I mean, we talked about and prayed about the weather all the time. You know, thank God, lovely day. Oh, please God, rain. We'll have a bit of rain tomorrow. Well, that prayer was usually answered. Oh, please God, we'll have a fine day tomorrow, cutting the hay or whatever. Now you just turn on the weather station. You get the weather for the next 7 days, no matter what prayers you say. Or think about all the ways and times that our grandparents, I have a personal story that I won't repeat, of my mother praying for a miracle when I had pneumonia. And she thought she was going to lose me, even though she'd already lost a little daughter. But her grandchildren wouldn't do what she did, would kneel down beside my bed and tell God she wasn't going to leave there till my fever broke. Her grandkids would just pop a kid in this SUV and be in the village in 10 minutes. And they get a shot of penicillin and it will be running around in a few days. So we don't need God the way we used to. So our disenchanted world kind of takes God and faith and pushes it to the edge of the stage, especially if we were just, if it was a God that we just was meeting our needs and so on. So that Taylor says that what our contemporary secular world proposes instead of God, instead of a transcendent perspective, is an exclusive humanism. And he uses the word exclusive to mean that it excludes any sense of the transcendent, any sense of the divine, any sense of the ultimate. It's a purely immediate way to satisfy. And it can work fine as long as everything is going well. But in the good time, I think life lived with faith in a transcendent ground is more human. You see, we're essentially spiritual beings. That old story that we're made in the image and likeness of God, it's not so much that we're human beings with a spiritual aspect. It'd be more to think of ourselves as spiritual beings with a human aspect. Because we're made in the image and likeness, we're essentially spiritual beings. And in a sense, I think that Catholic faith can enhance the high times, the low times, the weddings and the wakes, but also the everyday, that it has a potential and a possibility. Even in the midst of a disenchanted world, of offering people a rich, humanizing way to live, a way that's liberating, that's humanizing, and that enables us to live more humanly. My clicker. Well, we see now. Why won't? Well, let me move it on myself. Then you've got the challenges in our church. There's no need to belabor them here. God love us. It's so embarrassing, painful, difficult. The scandals that betray the gospel, betray our faith. You got the divisions, the revisions, the tensions around the Vatican II, around Pope Francis. You got the millennials questioning the whole rationale for beliefs, at least in the United States. The last Pew report on religion in America said there was 35 million people in the United States identified themselves as former Catholics. The largest religion in America is Catholic. Second largest religion in America is former Catholics. And you want to say, what are we doing that is so effective in driving people away? We're doing something. that is driving people away. But many of them say when they're interviewed that they no longer believe, that the beliefs are no longer convincing. And especially the beliefs in the ethical areas, in the moral. It's not that they're denying the divinity or humanity of Jesus or the Blessed Trinity or the real presence of the risen Christ in the Eucharist. They're never the issues. But there are always much more ethical issues and personal issues of personal ethic and disagreement with the church and women's rights and all kinds of things. But they also they need a more rational, a spiritual grounding for their beliefs, because the pure rationale won't work. There's a deep skepticism in modernity and in the secular age about the institutional authorities and meta-narratives, that nobody, meta-narratives is the whole notion that we have all the answers all the time for everybody, everywhere. And most of our younger people reject that and say, I don't believe that. But all of the overclaiming that our church has made, they basically reject it, and some of it's on good grounds. And some of it's on good grounds. And yet, I think there are blessings. Well, so while contemporary culture is tremendously challenging to traditional Catholic faith, I think there's tremendous blessings in contemporary culture as well, and in contemporary consciousness. And it has alerted us. It has sobered us. It has, in some ways, brought us to our knees in a very positive, in a painful way, but in what could be a life-giving way, what could be a turning point way. And especially has alerted us to biases and prejudices that we've had deeply rooted, and often quoting the Gospels to warrant them and to justify them, whereas they weren't justifiable at all. And you can think of all the contemporary movements. Feminist movement, for example, has confronted us as a church and as a faith community deeply with the sexism, with the misogyny, with the chauvinism that runs very deep in our church and in our representation of our faith. You'll find none of it in the Gospel of Jesus Christ. Find none of it whatsoever. Go back into the Gospels, and there he is, John chapter 4, the woman at the well. And it says right there in the text that the disciples came back from the village and were amazed to find him talking to a woman. So they should have been in the world and context and culture of the time. Rabbis never spoke. Strictly speaking, the Mosaic law forbid rabbis to speak to their wives even in the home, except when necessary. And here he was explaining his whole gospel to her at the well. And she was a sinful woman of 5 husbands already and now living with another man. And here he's explaining his whole gospel to her about the water that should be gushing up to eternal life. And she becomes his first evangelist, his first representative. She goes to her own people and says, I think I may have found the Messiah. She's the first evangelist in John's gospel. And it says right there in the text that the disciples came back from the village were amazed to find him talking to a woman. Or take the foot of the cross. All 3 synoptic gospels have the women at the foot of the cross. The men have all run away, gone back to Galilee, hightailed it out of there. But the women are at the foot of the cross, stood by him from the beginning to the end. And it says in all 3 synoptic gospels that the women, the names them Mary Magdalene and so on, the slightly different namings of them between the 3 gospels. But it says, and they had come up from Galilee with him. Which means if you take John's chronology, they'd been with him for 3 years. They'd been core members of his inner circle of disciples, deeply present. And of course, then Mary Magdalene is the first witness to the resurrection. She gets the title which she deserves. And Pope Francis recently gave it back to her because we'd taken it away. For about 500 or 600 years, she was always called the Apostola Apostolorum. She was the apostle to the apostles, because she saw him first. Says Mark chapter 16, verse 9, says, and he appeared first to Mary Magdalene and sent her as a witness to the other apostles. So she becomes the apostle to the apostles. And that was always her title, Apostola Apostolorum. So about the 7th century, and then some crazy pope got a hold of it and said she was the sinner. She was the whore. She was the sinful woman of Luke 7. It was concocted. And representing her then, you know, the scarlet woman and the sexy kind of lady, the seductress, for about 1,500 years. So finally, Pope Francis said, this is baloney. He said, Mary Magdalene was the first apostle, the leader of the apostles, and gave her back her title. The last 22nd of July last year, I had a minor hand in writing a letter that got taken to the Holy Father. And he looked at it and said, yeah, that's her proper title. the apostolorum. I had very little to do with it, but I had a very small hand in it. But all I'm saying is, but we didn't know that stuff. We didn't recognize that. And I could go on and on. We never noticed it until women started reading the scriptures, and as women get started training as scripture scholars, and until people start bringing a feminist perspective to rereading the tradition. And you can go on and on and on with any aspect. That stuff that our contemporary consciousness in many ways has brought us back to recognize the racism, the homophobia we've had, the championing unregulated capitalism. Francis keeps saying it doesn't work and it'll never work, and it's certainly not of Christian faith. But in a sense, the contemporary culture has helped us to reclaim what I would call recessive genes. They've been there all along in the tradition and in the scriptures. But recessive genes for human rights, for social justice, care for the environment, and so on. Why weren't we talking about care for the environment in the year 1500? We weren't. But also because we didn't need to. Because in the year 1500, we weren't capable of destroying it. Whereas now we are. We can put the pollutants into the air and the soil and the water that could indeed make life uninhabitable. So the church then has to rise up and say, this is a compelling, serious issue of our faith. But where does that come from? Well, it comes from the Gospels. It comes from Genesis. It's very clear. Genesis chapter 2, verse 15 says, "And you will be stewards of my creation." You will be stewards. God calls us when God made us to be stewards, to take care of God's creation. But we've forgotten that. And in some ways, we in the year 1500, we were incapable of destroying the environment, whereas we are now. So that in a sense, while contemporary world and culture and consciousness, and we talk about it as secular and pagan and all kinds of things, it also has tremendous gifts for us and helps us to go back and to reclaim aspects of the faith. That the whole notion that everybody's made in the image and likeness of God is always our foundational text. And it's not just in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 and 7. It's throughout the whole scriptures. It's repeated over and over again. So in other words, and as well as that, disenchantment. You see, disenchantment will always be confronted by the thin moments of God's presence. The old Celtic tradition that there are thin times, thin places, thin people, where the veil between the transcendent and the immanent gets lifted and becomes gossamer thin, where God's presence, in a sense, breaks through because God's grace will always be at work. I told a story, I'll repeat it briefly, but Justin will be bored by this, but a friend of mine, Joe, I met him recently for lunch. We were students together, we were doctoral students together at Columbia University, and we drank a lot of pitchers of beer deciding on Joe's atheism. And Joe chose to be an atheist, a Catholic atheist, but a very convinced atheist nonetheless. And this is 40 years ago. Joe went on, we parted ways, and we've remained friends over the years. I was in New York recently. He asked to have lunch with me. And Joe, shall we put it mildly, has been unlucky in love, shall we say. He's had a number of marriages and relationships, and I would say Joe himself had a hand in the failures of them. But anyway, I met him, and he's 66 years of age now. Tommy says, you won't believe it. You're not going to believe it. I have fallen madly in love with a wonderful woman. And he says, better still, she has fallen madly in love with me. And then he goes on, he just waxes eloquent about this beautiful woman, how much she loves him, he loves her. And he says, but Tom, I'm scared to death. I don't want to go back into some kind of a relationship again where I'll get hurt or lost. He says, I'm just terrified. What do you think? And I looked at him and said, Joe, I said, I think it's a gift from God. And he and me say, oh, Tom, now quit that crap. Now, I mean that we decided this 40 years ago. Now, I'm offended. I'm offended that kind of comment from you. Now, I mean, you know better than I what that means. That's offensive. That's offensive. I said, Joe, sorry. I apologize. Yeah. No, you're right, Joe. I bet it's just chemistry. And I waited. And after a while, I looked up and Joe had tears in his eyes. And he said, no, not just chemistry. And I knew Joe was having doubts about his atheism, just as we all have doubts about our theism. But this is a level playing field now. You see, we had the idea, the Enlightenment had the idea of a kind of a subtraction theory, and that faith would recede in front of reason, and that science would kind of enlighten us. And we'd realize that all that old stuff you believed when you were a kid, sure, that's all pishrogues. That was all your granny's pishrogues. And now that you've gone to school and got a bit of education, my God, one of the first things you'll do is stop believing. Baloney. It hasn't happened. It's proved false. 85% of the world still claims some kind of religious faith of some kind or other. And as I said, it's a level playing field. Belief and unbelief are both perspectives, as Taylor called them, takes. They're just perspectives on the ultimate questions of life, and both are challenged. Faith is always challenged by the ultimate challenge is always, why is there so much suffering in the world? If God is as good as we claim God is and as provident as God is, then why is there so much suffering and so much hatred and bitterness? On the other hand, atheists are always confronted, if there is no God, then why is there so much love and goodness and generosity in the world? We're both confronted. It's a level playing field. We're both challenged. And I think it could be an opportunity for a chosen faith, for a faith that appeals to the heart's desires of people. It could be a new moment in our time that we haven't had before. And it'll be a very different moment. We could be, I think we're in a time of deep transition out of a kind of a faith that was really more by coercion than persuasion. You had to believe it. Why do you have to believe? Well, the church said so. Well, nothing is ever true because the church said so. It's always true for a better reason, which of course is why the church says so. Or you had to believe. You don't believe you're going to hell. If you keep these rules and regulations, you could save your soul. But keeping these rules and regulations are their own reward. Loving the neighbor as yourself is the best way to live your life. To live in hatred and bitterness and anger is a miserable way to live. When he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, he wasn't kidding. It was a great way to live. If I would ever live the way Jesus modeled, what an extraordinary person I would be. How faithful, how hopeful, how loving, how kind, how merciful, how inclusive, how compassionate, how honest, how integral. It's an extraordinary life, the best possible way to live it. Not because it'll get me a reward later, but that's all of that old coercion that we had in our faith. You had to believe it. You know, the authority told you. I think we've the opportunity for a persuaded faith, for an embraced faith, for a faith that is our own, rather than just simply inherited. Now, I don't want in any way disparage inherited faith. I'm just saying we're in a different time. And it's a different challenge. And my question is, can we rise to the challenge? And I think we can. And I don't think we should just take our bat and ball and go home. Let me take you back into a few questions before we go to our break. I know you've been very patient. What do you name as major challenges? We're just going for about 5 more minutes before the break. What would you name as major challenges? Now, by the way, I've made some edits. So if you're looking down rather than looking up, you might be better off looking up. I'm an inveterate editor, so you won't find everything that I'm saying in the thing. You find it all of it. It'll all be waiting for you when you go home. But what would you name as some of the major challenges to educating for Christian faith in Ireland today? The first thing that comes to your mind, write it down. Why? And some of you have mentioned great challenges already, but write down what you think are the biggest challenges we have to educate for faith and for a faith outlook on life. Whatever the faith might be, it need not be necessarily a card-carrying party member of the Catholic Church. But how do you educate for spiritual wisdom and faith in people's lives? What's the challenges to that? And this is a good question. I think there are particularly Irish hopes for faith. There's a philosopher of our time, Michel Foucault, and he talks about that if you really want to get to know a culture, then you have to do an archaeology of it. In other words, you have to dig down deep into it. And as you the deeper down you go, you'll find layers and layers and layers of tradition and meaning and values that you didn't even know were there. And yet they continue to shape the ordinary and the everyday. And you wouldn't even know where they're coming from. But they're coming from the archaeology. They're coming from the deep down stuff. So as you think about some of the deep down stuff of Irish identity and faith, what might be some sources of hope for faith? There was an old Seanochal, I don't remember the Gaelic, I remember the Irish, the English, that a quenched coal is easily lit. Those coals in the grate, when you come down in the morning and you want to light a fire, the embers from the night before can start the fire, help start a fire. So my question is, are there faith embers in the Irish archaeology that could be lit? Might be fanned to flame. Think about them. Let me invite you back to the neighbor. 3 or 4 minutes again. We'll break by 25 after, and we'll give you a decent break because I'm sure you're dying for the stretch your legs. Let me just finish out this section and then, because I want to go into the what faith and when we come back. But take 3 minutes with the neighbor and tell them, what do you think might be signs of hope for faith, even particularly Irish signs of hope? Go to work, 3 minutes, we'll come back, we'll hear 3 minutes, and then we'll take our break.
I think what happened in Ireland, of course, Tom, is that it became the domain of the clergy. And
exactly.
Lost that.
Yeah. When you're ready, we'll come back together. And I did a bit of reading before coming, and of course I've been back to Ireland 70 times in the last 40 years, so it's not as if I've been gone. But I'm not nearly as attuned to it as you are. But one of the statistics I read was a recent research that indicate that over 73-74% of Irish people admit, and the word was admit, to pray at least once a week. And something like whatever it is, 30%, 35% are going to Mass regularly, but over 70% pray regularly. So that there's a deep faith. There's a deep faith that shouldn't be underrated at all. Grace Davey, the great English sociologist, she often says that we got all kinds of believers without belonging. They believe, but they don't belong very much. They don't show up too often. And that can be people of deep faith. And so you may not end up turning out a lot of card-carrying party members. No, maybe you will. But you can still educate people for faith. Let me make a couple of quick suggestions that just occurred to me, and these may sound like the romanticisms of an exile and thinking that it's still the way it was when I was young, etc. But I think there are still deep, deep embers. The generosity to the poor. Now, we often take that for granted. Actually, everybody doesn't do it. Everybody doesn't do it at all. I was saying to Justin last night, I've spent some time over the years in Korea. The Koreans, in their Confucian tradition, have a deep personal ethic. There's almost no theft. There's no such thing as stealing. Modern-day Korea has changed, but in traditional Korea, there was no such thing as stealing. Nobody stole. But there was also no sense of a social ethic. There was a deep personal morality, but no sense of caring for the poor, the downtrodden. So that we often think that this is all what everybody is. No, it's deeply grounded in our Catholic faith. We're the third in the world, apparently, still, in giving to the poor, and especially to places of famine. And of course, that's no coincidence. That's the memory of the Gortamura, of our own people. But it's a deep source of faith. Jesus says it. I was hungry, you gave me to eat. I was thirsty. Yesterday's gospel reading in the common lectionary. I was hungry. I was thirsty. I was in prison. I was sick and you visited me. Jesus will not say to us, there was a hungry person one time and you fed them. Jesus will say, I was hungry. He gave me to eat. So that sense of finding God in the poor and in our service to the poor, I think is a very likely seed of faith. And our young people are so committed to this that I think that's a marvelous beginning. The commitment to social justice, not just to compassion, but to the works of justice, not just feeding the hungry, but asking why are they hungry in the first place in a world where we're perfectly capable of feeding them. Obviously, the social political structures are to blame, and taking that on as well. The sense of community that is still there, I know it's receding in the cities and all the rest of it, but it's very deep still, and a community of care. I haven't experienced anything like it since I left this country 45 years ago. Nothing comparable to that village. And that village is still a village. People are still good to each other and kind to each other and good neighbors to each other and look out for each other. Even though there's a 6-lane highway now to Dublin. The love of nature, I think there's a deep aspect, especially of Celtic spirituality, that sense of God, seeing the presence of God in all things, finding God in the midst of the ordinary and everyday, and especially in God's creation. A positive outlook on life. Now, again, we can take that for granted and think everybody, but you don't find it everywhere. There are some cultures and contexts that live in a deep kind of depression. But this positive outlook on life, there's an old fellow in my village, Joe. When you'd ask Joe was a very poor person, and in poor health a lot of his life, God love him. But you'd ask Joe, how are things, Joe? And Joe's stock answer, I still hear it in my memory so clear. He'd say, not too bad, not too bad. Now, Joe came by our house every day and got his lunch. And I always loved how my mother would do it, because she'd go out, Joe would be coming walking by just perchance at around dinner time, about 12 noon. And she'd go out and say, Joe, excuse me now, Joe, lovely to see you. Joe, you know what? I cooked way too much dinner again today, and I hate to see it going to waste. Would you do me a great favor now if you'd ever come in and finish it up for me? And he'd say, well, now, Maggie, I've had my dinner already now, but I hate to see good food go to waste. So no, I will. I'll come in and I'll finish it up. But I loved how she did it, because she maintained his dignity. She'd never go out and say, Joe, have your dinner ready. Come on in. Yeah, there you are, looking for your dinner again. And it was this game they played, and she knew, and he knew the game, and yet they kept each other's dignity and so on. But when you say to Joe, how are things? He said, not too bad. They were bloody miserable. But from Joe's perspective, sure, they weren't too bad, you know. That positive outlook on life, and it comes from a faith. It comes from faith. And as I said, when you go and spend a little time in other cultures and you notice that it's not there, you say, now, where did we get it? The faith response to death, as somebody already mentioned, I think it can be very, very powerful. And our insistence on honoring the dead and burying the dead and marking the places of the dead. And it's such a deep aspect. And our response that can happen at the funerals, and even in my village, even the drunks show up and they'll celebrate and be at the mass and help to carry the coffin and bury the dead and pray for them. It's a deeply spiritual thing still. And I think the poetry, the storytelling, the conversation, our ability for imagination, I think that there's a deep source of faith there. Just a quickie from Paddy Kavanagh. It was the garden of the golden apples, a long garden between a railway and a road. In the sow's rooting, where the hen scratches, we dipped our fingers in the pockets of God. And it runs all through the poets, even, you know, Yeats, Heaney, the whole lot of them. This sense of the transcendent and the imagination and the reach for the transcendent through the poetic. I think we still have deep roots. Let's take a 10-minute break. Sorry for going a bit over time, my apology. We'll come back at about 20 to 12 then.